Welcome to the Washington AI Network podcast. I'm Tammy Haddad, the founder of the Washington AI Network. We bring together official Washington insiders and AI experts who are challenging, debating, and just trying to figure out the rules of the road for artificial intelligence. Today is a special podcast because we have one of the best technology reporters joining us. Ina Fried is the chief technology reporter for Axios and author of the daily Axios AI Plus newsletter. She is here in DC for the Axios AI Summit this week. We can talk about that another day. But Ina, we have to start with OpenAI. Give us the latest. You were right in the middle of every news story. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, it was one of the craziest 100 hours of my reporting career for sure. I've never seen anything quite like it. And I think a large reason is it's a board unlike any other. So I'm used to corporate boards and they have a unique set of responsibilities, but there's also a playbook. And I think what made OpenAI so open to this kind of drama is the fact that as a nonprofit board, there is no playbook.
Right. But the question is, how did it get that far? I mean, we know that, you know, there's been turnover of all the staff, but do you have any more insight? Like, there's been reporting that it's about the Q technology. Do you think that's true, that that's what broke them up?
I don't think it is. I think a lot of this is personalities and people. It's funny that we're talking about AI technology and all these things, but I think at the end of the day, it was about human beings and a lack of trust both ways among the board and Sam Altman and the execs.
And they had been together for years.
Yeah, I mean, it had been largely carrying forward and moving along, but you saw the board change composition pretty radically as Reid Hoffman and a couple other people left that really brought that business sense and that business experience. And you were left with a much smaller group of people pretty focused on the long-term technology picture and sort of this mission of safely bringing really powerful AI, often called artificial general intelligence, to the world. And I think there was a real gap between the business goals of Sam and the board's vision for safe AI, which there wasn't much overlap.
So Eric Schmidt spoke at your AI conference, and he said that Sam Altman's in a better position. He's Steve Jobs. He's bigger than AI itself to a certain extent. He said, do you agree?
I don't know that he's bigger than AI itself, but he's certainly in a stronger position now than he was before the coup a week ago.
But isn't there going to be an investigation?
There is. And I mean, certainly things could change if the investigation turns up what public deems as wrongdoing or the new board. That would be one thing. But I think barring some bombshell finding, I think we'll see a board that is more aligned with his business interests than the past board, which was largely focused on the technology and not even, I mean, what's fascinating is they had talked in the past about a rival was ahead, helping the rival. Like, they were really a nonprofit board in ways that I've never seen in business.
And so Microsoft, they kind of win in all of this too.
I think they do. I think there's still some potholes out there for them in terms of they still don't fully own the technology. They have broad set of rights. Had OpenAI ceased to exist, Microsoft still would have had the technology it needs. So they do have quite broad rights, but that's different than it being your own technology in-house. That said, I think Microsoft, like Sam, is stronger now than they were a week ago.
And how do you explain the board, the decision of Larry Summers and others to come in there? No women, no anyone of color. I mean, there's so many issues, which I want to get into with you about making sure that AI is fair and equitable. But is that just throwing it back in people's faces that this isn't important and we just get to decide everything?
It is a red flag to me. I mean, if you're going to talk about how important this technology is and that it's going to change all of our lives, I would think you would want a board that represents a wide variety of interests, not for diversity's sake, but because this technology needs to serve a broad group of people. And I got some pushback in my email of folks saying, you want quotas, et cetera. No, I just think it's hard to have any board be in charge of such a powerful technology, and you want a broad range of experiences. Now, the good news is it's not going to stay a three-person board. They're going to find other people. However, you know, I do think there's some warning signs there. We all know Larry Summers' comments that, you know, got him in hot water before about women in STEM. And that certainly wouldn't make me feel represented by that board.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's throwing it back in people's faces. Like, you think this should be our priority, but clearly it wasn't. And was Microsoft part of that decision?
Oh, there were so many parties involved. And I think some of what we saw was, who could everyone agree on? And that's not necessarily, you know, seeking out the perfect, most qualified candidates as much as it is, who is someone that we all can live with, which was necessary to get beyond the situation they were in. I hope there's a really different approach to filling out the rest of the board.
Well, back to Larry Summers, because he's long affiliated with Andreessen Horowitz. I wonder if someone there had to be satisfied. And that's why, I mean, clearly they didn't pick this person for a public announcement. So sorry to be suspicious here on the East Coast, but it made me very suspicious of those on the West Coast.
Well, I will say they were trying to please a very, not just large group of people. You had investors, you had the outgoing board members who wanted to be satisfied that they had achieved some change and that the company would be in good hands. You had people that Sam could live with because he's not on the board, nor is Greg Brockman, who's now back at the company as president, but neither of them are on the board. So I think it was a very delicate dance, and I think the messiness is visible.
Oh, yes. Intrigue. This is definitely going to be a great HBO film. I just want to point that out as someone who works for HBO.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the books and the miniseries, et cetera. There was a lot of who's going to play who in the movie. You know, it really was just an incredible drama. And being right there in the middle of it, it was not always clear which directions it was going. Like, you would talk to people and you could see there wasn't necessarily an end game that was clear. I think Microsoft played probably the strongest game of chess in all this. You know, they put out that, you know, brilliant move that they were going to hire Sam and Greg. And I think they would have been willing, but I don't think that was necessarily the preferred outcome. I think they're pretty happy just having Sam back in place and new leadership and new board.
And do you think they were trying to apply pressure by having Satya Nadella do, what was it, like 6 interviews that day?
He did 3, but that's a lot for Satya. And maybe he did more. I certainly saw at least 3 interviews, and he wanted to make a couple of points, and he made those. They were points he was making to the board via the public, but really saying that not only was Sam going to have a big role either at OpenAI or with Microsoft and most of OpenAI's staff, but that they wanted change on the board because Microsoft owns 49% of the for-profit entity, but they don't have representation on the old board. They don't have representation yet on the new board, and they may not, given that it remains a nonprofit board. I think they're going to want to find ways to have say whether or not they have board representation.
Do you think there's any long-term implications for other AI companies and with investors? Because just for this point, I know it was an odd structure, but does that mean investors will now say, we've got to be on the board, or we've got to have a larger say, or is this just a wash?
I mean, this is such a unique, unusual company. I don't think most people would invest in a company with a nonprofit board. I mean, you have some interests that are fundamentally not lined up with each other. And that hasn't changed. So if I'm investing in a company as a venture capital firm in particular, I'm looking to maximize profit. They're a capped profit entity, which as a journalist doesn't bother me at all. I think it's kind of nice, but it's not my money on the line.
Let's turn. You've talked to Ali Mayorkas, the DHS secretary at the summit, and talked about the uses of AI. Is there anything he said that made you nervous, or did you feel more comfortable about the way government plans to use AI?
He certainly said all the right things. There was nothing he said that made me go, ooh, I have worries, except I don't have the worries I came in with aren't necessarily soothed in terms of this is an incredibly powerful technology. And I think there's a lot of history in the United States of using powerful technologies in ways that may prevent some terrorism, but that also come right up against civil liberties. And it's a very difficult balance. I feel like he conveyed the challenges of that balance, and I think has put in place some of the right processes in terms of having AI ethics and civil rights and privacy people involved in decision-making. That is what you want to see. At the same time, I think a lot of groups want to see rules in place that don't depend on the goodwill of any particular leader or administration. I certainly would worry about those same technologies in the hands of an administration for whom civil liberties was not a top priority of any party.
Okay, you have to tell how you know Ali Mayorkas.
It's a great story. So I hadn't seen him until yesterday in 30 years, but we spent a lot of time together 30 years ago. He was the second chair, so an assistant U.S. attorney, not the lead prosecutor, but one of the main prosecutors in the federal trial of Hollywood Madam Holly Fleiss. Heidi Fleiss. And she was the madam to the stars in Hollywood at the time. It was a huge case, lots of scandal. And I was a cub reporter for City News Service, a tiny little wire in Los Angeles, working for the summer. And I spent 3 or 4 weeks covering federal court that happened to just overlap with that trial. And I was the reporter in the courthouse day in, day out. Sometimes I was the only person not affiliated with the case in the courtroom, and he was there. And it was mostly seeing each other from afar, though we talked a few times, and it was great to reconnect.
Well, we really enjoyed it. Okay, he did talk about facial recognition, and there's a case in Illinois. Can you talk about that? Because this is on the move in states.
Yeah, what we've seen over the last few years, as Congress has been unable to pass, anything, what we've seen is that in a lot of cases, the lead when it comes to what the rules are either comes from Europe and gets adopted globally by the companies, or more often comes from one state or a couple of states. And either that state regulation becomes the default, or that's the catalyst that finally gets the federal government to act, in part because what you'll see tech companies do, if there's a state regulation they don't like, is they'll try and get a federal legislation that addresses the same area with either less teeth or softer rules that then gets adopted federally. They tried that with privacy. We still don't have that. So the states still rule when it comes to privacy. Illinois has a facial recognition law that has basically, in the absence of any federal regulation, become the default. And we've seen companies sued and had to pay out money for violating that Illinois law, whereas in the other 49 states, they're pretty much free to do that.
And what about California? Where are they on AI regulation?
We haven't seen a big bill yet. We've seen some cities restrict. And with facial recognition, there's several different uses that some believe the government needs to take a stand on. One is, how can private citizens use facial recognition? You know, what rights of privacy do you have? Can it be mandatory, et cetera? But probably the bigger one is, how can the government itself use AI? And it's obviously tricky because you're asking the government to limit its own use, particularly police use, but not only police use. We've seen some cities, because again, we haven't seen states really act on this, ban their police forces from using facial recognition. And remember, this is a very powerful technology, but not yet accurate, not yet equitable, in that it's more effective at identifying men and white people than it is women and people of color. And if you're going to use that as part of law enforcement, a system that's already got its fair share of biases, adding bias technology is problematic.
Is anyone working hard on bias technology?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of people that are looking at what we have when it comes to AI and saying, wow, that's really just taken all of our human biases and codified it. And we've been writing about this for years now, saying this is a really critical moment. Because if we're not careful, within a couple of years, these black box systems will just have that bias. We won't even be able to see it, and it'll just be baked in. So there are folks working on it. The challenge is, it's really hard. It's not always obvious. Sometimes it is today, and I'm quick to point that out. If you type in engineer into a lot of AI engines, whether it's drawing a picture, you'll get a bunch of white men or that sort of thing. So sometimes you can see it and be like, okay, that's something we've got to work on. It, even then, it takes work. It takes somebody saying, wow, when we type in engineer or doctor, we're getting this set of photos. How do we work on that? So it's a massive problem. There are people working on it, both within large companies as well as startups, but I don't know that the large companies are placing enough of a priority on it to really move the needle.
And what about government? In the executive order the president announced, there's going to be 400. Each government agency has to have an AI officer. Do you know 400 people? You would want to take these jobs? I mean, you're covering this every day.
My colleague Ryan Heath wrote about this, and I think they are gonna struggle to have the talent they need broadly. I mean, this is always a problem, especially for the federal government, because it has limits on pay, and private companies want this AI talent badly, and they just, you know, keep raising the price. I think it's great to have someone who's responsible, but it's not sufficient. So even let's say for a moment they found 400 great people, which I think will be a challenge, that alone isn't sufficient, because really you have to have the commitment from the top. And we've seen this, you know, the best example I can give is companies that have a chief diversity officer. And that alone sometimes makes the problem worse, because it gives permission to everyone else to kind of push it to that person. And often they don't have the authority to do things. So they create programs and things. But, you know, what really has made a difference is the companies that have tied it to compensation for the CEO. Suddenly a lot more gets done. Now, this is different. This is about the technology. And you do want someone who's really thinking, how can we take this new set of technologies and do what we do better? And I think that's especially true for the federal government, which is not necessarily known for being a first mover when it comes to technology.
Should there be an agency, one super agency that looks at it? Is that possible? I mean, what do you think the answer is?
It's possible. I think it usually takes a catalyst, which is not necessarily someone whose official job, you know, I'm thinking of Megan Smith when she was CTO under Obama, really looking at all the agencies and how could they do it better. But you have to get buy-in. You know, Washington, you know it better than I do. You can't just dictate. So another agency without the right leader would be problematic. I think having someone internal may work better. Again, the key is the who, and really being a catalyst for change and convincing what is a giant bureaucracy, or many, you know, collections of giant bureaucracies, that it's going to be better. And I think there's a lot of fear. Look, it's the same with companies. Everyone looks at AI and they see something that they're excited about, but everyone looks at it and sees something they're worried about. And often the thing they're worried about is their job. And I think that's going to be a challenge when it comes to the federal government, when people look at these generative AI technologies and see it doing some of what they get paid to do every day. I think we're going to see some resistance.
Well, Rohit Chopra, the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, spoke at your summit, and he came out and basically said, we have a lot of laws on the books now to handle all these kinds of things. But you've got all these companies who said, we want regulation. Sam Altman has said, we want regulation. What are you hearing now in San Francisco and these hubs of AI research and innovation? Do they really want government regulation?
They want a baseline. They want to know what they absolutely can't do, but they would like that bar set pretty low, would be my guess. If you gave truth serum out to these executives, I think they want the bar set so that they don't have to do things that are unethical or bad from their perspective. Because to the degree there's a law that states it, then they don't have to worry about their competitors do it. So I do think there's some genuine desire for some amount of regulation, but I wouldn't think that the regulation that Sam Altman and other tech execs are looking for is the limit of what we as a society might want. And as for the legislation that's on the books, it's actually pretty powerful, but it only covers certain uses. So, for example, you're required as a lender not to discriminate on a variety of bases. That's true whether loan officer Joe Schmo makes the decision or an AI algorithm. So we will see, I'm pretty confident, we will see lawsuits that say, look at the pattern, look at the outcomes. And we have enough data to say the outcomes are discriminatory, ergo you violated, you know, the Fairness in Lending Act or whichever law it is that governs that. There's similar laws around housing and employment. I think these AI algorithms are going to be used pervasively enough that that's not sufficient. And I would want to see similar legislation that covers uses that aren't covered today by the types of anti-discrimination laws that cover housing, employment, lending. And it's also being used in things like parole and sentencing, where there's just an enormous potential for bias, even if you're just looking at history.
So what happens in that all this data has gone in already? So how does it get straightened out? So now you're really talking about you have to straighten it out, coming out, whatever the product is.
It's a really tough problem. I mean, what we're seeing right now is a lot of banding. So if you look at ChatGPT today, for example, the data is what the data is. And then they have a lot of rules designed to prevent certain types of harmful results from showing up. So they do that some degree by modifying or moderating the queries. So if you ask for something that's likely to generate childhood sex abuse material or a recipe for a bomb, it's going to, you know, do the sci-fi thing. Sorry, I can't do that. They're also looking at the data. And when they spot something biased coming out, even if that's what the data shows, they're also interrupting some of those results. One, I think that's not a very scalable or elegant solution. It's not very permanent. And I'm also convinced, given the society we live in, we're going to see alternative AI systems that remove those band-aids because they like the racism and hate and other things that these engines are capable of spewing. So I think we need more systemic solutions, but I know from talking to researchers that that's a lot harder to do.
Let's talk about Elon Musk. How do you think he comes out on everything that happens with OpenAI? Does it give him and his organization a larger opportunity to step in?
I mean, he'll use any opportunity. And I think we've already seen him, I think, use several opportunities here to make a point or two that he wants. I definitely think the AI product that he's working on, he's already made pretty clear, isn't going to be, to use his term, woke, which means I think we'll see a lot of bias, particularly in the areas where we've seen it, both from him and his company. You know, he tweets and says things that are biased against a whole range of groups. And I would be shocked if he creates an AI product that's much different than his thing. I think the drama at OpenAI gives him a little breathing room. I think the other area that benefits a lot of leaders in Silicon Valley, and everyone sort of acknowledges it, but no one really likes to talk about it, is because he's so outlandish, because the things he says are so outrageous, because his policies of, you know, firing people on a whim, making everyone come back to the office, those may be extreme, but it gives a lot of CEOs in Silicon Valley and beyond permission to do things that are a step in that direction that they've been wanting to take. And it's like, well, at least I'm not Elon.
Let's talk about Twitter and OpenAI, because all the action was on Twitter. So in a way, this sort of promotes the kind of, you know, X that Elon Musk wants.
Yeah, it certainly sucked me back in. I spent a lot of time on X. I've been trying to spend less time there and really think, why am I here? What am I trying to do? Notice when my blood pressure rushes and kind of log off. And that had been my practice for a while. I also tried to use it as an opportunity to just notice, you know, who's being hurt and send a kind word. I called it love scrolling as opposed to doom scrolling. But I spent a lot of time just like seeing someone that was getting beat up and just sending a note, hey, sorry, you're going through this. And so that helped make my time on X more meaningful. But in general, I was trying to spend less time. And yeah, this was the place to be. It was like the Twitter of old. Now, I think it's important to remember, this was a very narrow thing affecting Silicon Valley, a very plugged in community that was already on X. I do think X has declined as a place where, for the average news event, a lot of news is being broken. There's plenty of discussion. If you want a whole vitriol-filled discussion of politics, of Russia, of Israel, X is still a great place. But when it comes to the news actually being first on X, this was the first time in a while where I felt that was the case. We were all chasing the story. Different people were breaking it. We were, I think, breaking a bunch of stories, but so was The Information. So was Bloomberg, The New York Times, others. So kind of had to be there.
And what about Linda Yaccarino, the CEO? Do you think she survives? There's been lots of rumors that she's going to be out because advertising rates are down there.
I mean, I don't think it's reasonable to blame Linda for advertisers fleeing. I think one need look no further than Elon Musk to see the reason they're leaving. You know, it's always struck me as an essentially unwinnable position. I mean, you're taking something that is fundamentally not safe for brand advertisers and having even a seasoned ad executive try and convince them that it's safe in the ways that they define safety, which is, I don't want to see my ads next to certain types of content, but also I don't want my ad to be a liability. I think Twitter does have areas where it's more effective at advertising, sort of direct response and getting people to take an action, sign up for something, follow something that's still its core. And I think advertisers are a little bit reluctant to give that up, but I think they're also, they like safety in numbers. So as soon as we reported that Apple was leaving, suddenly most of Hollywood followed that day. And this was right that same Friday that Sam Altman was fired.
Right.
Earlier that morning, we reported that Apple was pausing its advertising. And by the afternoon, before Sam was fired, you had most of Hollywood doing the same. And I don't think you would have seen any one of those studios unilaterally pull out, but they were all dealing with this same balance of, I don't want to incur Elon's wrath, but I want to be there. And my customers are there. I mean, I heard from a lot of advertisers, you know, the people are there. It's hard to just pull out. And they did.
And what about Threads? Because people didn't move to Threads.
It's just not quite there at critical mass. I think it's certainly the largest momentum. Sort of ironic that the, you know, revolt against tech and Elon is to go to Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg, but that's the world we apparently are living in. All the independent efforts really didn't gain scale. And I think the OpenAI drama, the reason it didn't play out anywhere else is you didn't have the critical mass of people.
Let's turn to journalism and AI. Wall Street Journal is delivering some AI materials. How worried are you about that?
I think AI has a tremendous role in most fields, including journalism, and I've written a bunch about this, to improve things, to use AI. I use AI in ways every day. I think there's a right way and a wrong way. To me, the absolute wrong way is to feed a bunch of stuff into ChatGPT and ask it to write an article. It'll do it, but that's not, it's not a step up, it's not an improvement, and that's not what it's good for. I do believe there will be writing tools designed for journalists that help us do our jobs better. And I think there will be a role, I hope not the defining role, for content that is summarized, curated, and aggregated using AI means. It's really good at that. It's very good at summarizing. It's very good at aggregating. It's also useful at finding needles and patterns in haystacks. So I would expect to see a lot of good data-driven journalism that before would have been, you'd have to pick and choose your projects so carefully because they were so human labor intensive. And now you can really, you could plug in a ton of census data, for example, and find demographic trends of, you know, which schools are underperforming or other types of things that would have been hard before. So I think there's great opportunity, but journalism also depends on human judgment, assessing credibility, building relationships, holding truth to power. And those are things that I think AI is particularly well suited for.
Truth to power. So let's talk about the 2024 election. Again, the same question. What are you worried about on the AI front for this election? We've already had misinformation, disinformation, deep fakes.
We weren't doing well as a society before AI arrived on the scene when it comes to misinformation. You had a lot of people who believed that a very effective, very safe vaccine was not those things. You had a lot of people spreading the word about things that weren't shown to be effective. You had, by all official accounts, by all investigations, by all lawsuits, a free and fair election that a lot of people questioned. So that was the landscape heading into this generative AI boom. I do believe that generative AI is going to make it cheaper and easier and more compelling to spread misinformation. So I think all the problems we had in the last two presidential elections will be magnified. I think there are a lot of tools, but again, they're mostly in the hands of the platforms because anyone can write anything. That's been the case since the advent of the internet. What changed with social media was the ability of a voice, whether it was a prominent voice to begin with or an unknown voice, to be dramatically amplified. And those conditions are still in place. And what worries me is I've actually seen the big platforms step off the gas when it comes to moderating content, feeling like we're going to get treated badly by one side or the other, no matter what. Why spend all this money? Why take away revenue to moderate content only to, again, find themselves in trouble with a different political party? They're still getting hauled into court. So I'm pretty concerned about how aggressively all of the platforms address misinformation, you know, starting with X, of course, because I think we've seen X, unlike the others, take stands of its own via its owner. I mean, Elon Musk has made his political stripes pretty clear in what he individually says, in who he engages with, in the types of speech that are condoned on the platform. There's certainly, I think that's the most obvious example, but I think don't ignore YouTube and Meta in this. A lot of misinformation spreads on those platforms.
And, you know, there's not just the U.S. 2024 election, there's elections all over the world. Do you think anything that Europe is doing, any regulations will help on that front? Will they be a leader in some way to help these elections, or they're just on the side of this?
I mean, Europe is leading in regulation. There's no question. I don't know that it's elections. That I think is a different question. And I'm not sure the types of things that Europe is looking at. They are more systemic. I think they benefit democracy in the long term. I don't think they necessarily improve what happens. Whole slate of elections, which, as you point out, isn't just in the U.S., that's coming up in the next couple of years. And I do think we're seeing political candidates very savvy to what's out there. And I also caution people, you know, we are going to live in a world of deep fakes. It's here, it's cheap, it's easy. But there's a second problem that comes with that. Just the mere existence of that technology allows me to take a video that I don't like, that's legitimate, and say what the former president said throughout his term, fake news. The idea that it is possible that any given piece of content is a deep fake allows you to suddenly claim, oh, what you see with your own two eyes isn't real. So even if there aren't compelling deep fakes, just the ability to deny truth is a problem in a world where deep fakes are possible.
And is there any group, any organization that you've come across that you think could possibly change that narrative?
I think one of the most promising longer term things I see is this content authenticity initiative. Adobe helped spearhead it, but they've got lots and lots of people involved, which is saying, let's verify from the moment a piece of content is captured, what got changed. So I do think that's promising, but only if most of the world's content is verified. Then when there's something particularly salacious and it's not verified, then you start to question it. But if it continues to be the way it is right now, where a tiny fraction of video and photos are authenticated, that's not good enough because the bad guys are never going to submit their fake video or photo to be authenticated.
Do you think government might endorse that? I thought it was incredible technology. Or do we need the governments to endorse it?
I don't think we need the governments. I think we need certainly Apple and Google, for example, to build it into the smartphone camera. Mm-hmm. Again, this only works if there's critical mass.
And do you think Apple has any interest in that?
It certainly fits with their
privacy.
So, and democracy and freedom and all that stuff. I think the hard part is it wasn't invented by them. It's an open standard. So there may be a little hesitancy to put resources into embracing something that just makes them one of a group. But Apple does embrace standards. It's not unheard of. I do think it would be a benefit to democracy if every picture taken on an Android or iOS smartphone had this technology at least available. It'll still be optional, I think.
Is Google looking at that?
I don't know exactly where Google's at, but Qualcomm, which makes the chips that run in a lot of Android phones, though notably not the Pixel, but all of Samsung's main phones, they have said, we're going to build this technology into our next processor.
Well, that's an incredible positive note. Thank you so much, Ina. It's so great having you in DC where you belong.
Well, I'm always around here. Axios is based in outside of DC, so I come here quite a bit. Thanks for having me, Tim.
Oh, and by the way, thank you for the Mike Allen robot greeting me at the door.
Yeah, there's a Mike Allen juice dispenser we had at our summit. I have to say, it was a little creepy hearing Mike's voice coming out of a robot.
Thank you so much, Ina.
Thanks, Tammy.
Looking for the perfect gift this holiday season? Or just a sweet way to treat yourself or someone special? The Washington AI Network is proud to support the mission of Dogtag Bakery. Dogtag is a living business school for transitioning veterans with service-connected disabilities, military spouses, and caregivers. The program helps them develop critical skills to find renewed purpose, community, and to find success for themselves with greater confidence and direction. You can visit Dogtag Bakery on Gray Street in Georgetown in Washington or place an order online right now at dogtaginc.org. Support the mission. Their signature brownies and cookies will keep you coming back for more. Check out their holiday baskets, perfect for clients or family and friends. Thank you for listening to the Washington AI Network podcast. Be sure to subscribe and join the conversation. The Washington AI Network is a bipartisan forum bringing together the top leaders and industry experts to discuss the biggest opportunities and the greatest challenges around AI. The Washington AI Network podcast is produced and recorded by Haddad Media. Thanks for listening.